50 seconds. Okay. Micah.
All right.
Homepage. I'm going there now, Drew. With 2 seconds. Perfect. That's perfect, bro. Oh, yeah. That's perfect. That's better than I thought. That's perfect. 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 Drew, thank you so much.
Tell the geek I said hello.
All right, Micah says hello.
All right.
Love you, bye.
You didn't say hello back?
I didn't care.
Okay, here we go, guys. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
All systems go, Geronimo!
This is the Grailian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grailian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From hundreds of miles beneath Terra Firma and the depths of the Hollow Earth, live from the Grailian Bunker, welcome one and all. It is the Grailian Report. I am Micah Hanks. Glad, as always, to be in pocket with you guys every Monday night as we go spinning cosmogirally through space and time via the marvels of KGRARadio.com, our home on the darkest corner of the web. Darkest, if not only, for the illumination that is always brought to the table by my friend, my cohort, and my companion in space and time, Mr. Matt Oakley. Good evening to you, sir.
Eve to you as well.
Always good to hear your voice and see your face, sir. Glad to have you here in pocket, Grailian International Studios, and all you guys out there tuning in live. Hope you're all doing well. Quick shout out to everybody there in the chat room. If you're listening on live and you haven't joined us yet, kgraradio.com/chat is the place to do that. Also, a quick hello to all our friends over there on TalkStream Live, carrying our broadcast. Lots of places where you can do that. TuneIn Radio. Yeah, all over the place. And in fact, as we're going from place to place tonight, we're going to be remembering a late and what I believe to be truly a great cryptozoologist, a man who tried to bring science to that field, in a field that is often, well, probably far from being scientific. It's really often left to the weekend warriors. We're going to be looking at that. We're going to be looking at some scientific ideas about consciousness. And of course, we'll also be delving into a bit of discussion of things that have been happening in, well, not only the world right now, but on this day in history. More on that in a moment. But first, I do want to acknowledge our man with the plan back in Master Control. He's always got a big hand on that master console there. KGRA Studios, Mr. Race Hobbs, the Hobbo, the Hobster, the Hobbit himself. How you doing, brother?
I can't complain. I'm blessed. Micah, how you and the Reverend doing on this wonderful Monday?
Well, we're doing great. Things are starting to warm up a little bit. The days are beginning to get longer, and Asheville, North Carolina is looking more and more beautiful by the day. We finally got through all that rain yesterday. I got to tell you, I was traveling over the weekend, and traveling throughout the Southeast, Dakota, our good friend, you know, he and I, we stopped by the Okmulgee National Monument down in Georgia, made our way back home, and yesterday was just bleak, rainy. I mean, you just want to try and bunker down, whether or not you have a bunker like we do, and not have to even look outside, let alone go outside. But I had to venture out at one point. Yeah, today was much nicer. I gotta be honest, I love that rainy, stay inside and read a book weather. To a point, but after you've had so much of it, you're just dying for some sunshine. Vitamin D deficiency, I guess.
I know it. That is true. I'm just like you. I love and cherish the rain, but after a while, man, it can really gray your day.
Well, it can, and I always worry these days when I'm seeing too much of it. Yes, we definitely want rain, but if I start seeing too much rain after a cold winter, where of course we've got, you know, the precipitation builds up, icy, and also the aqueous variety, when we start getting into the spring and the summer, what starts happening is that runoff heads down to the lowlands, and we see the water levels rise down in the creeks and things. And as you guys know, I love to go down to South Carolina, where I am a licensed hobby diver, and look for artifacts, relics, and items of paleontological interest. But when the creeks are really high, it is extremely hard to do that and not be eaten by Hello. Somebody having some trouble there? I think we've got some trouble back in master control.
Lightning strikes.
Was that actually lightning?
No. I lost my channel. I don't know what happened. So I just jerked the wire out and plugged it back in.
That always does it. That and kicking it really hard.
You don't pull it out. You don't, you know, ease it out. You jerk it right out of there and then just slam it back in the hole.
That always works for me.
That way you don't have these issues for another 3 months.
Well, yeah. As I was saying, though, the problem that I face often is you get out in the deep water and you're at risk of being consumed by alligators and alligator snapping turtles and even regular snapping turtles. Yeah.
But I want to make sure you utilize the correct vernacular and colloquialisms here. It's not creek, it's crick, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah. Crick. That a boy, man.
And I thought the only crick that I had right now was the one in my neck after sleeping on hotel pillows Friday night. But hey, you know, you can't win them all, right?
You got to bring your MyPillow along with you.
Well, they haven't sponsored me yet, but we're working on that. So, as you guys know, of course, I love history. It doesn't always have to be the ancient past either. Sometimes it has to do with things that are, well, quite frankly, a lot more relevant to what's happening right now with the furtherance of our exploration of space. We're seeing a move toward private space programs. And there's always that ever lingering threat when things can go wrong. And even with a great degree of financing and preparation, I mean, unfortunately, it's almost inevitable that things will happen. And on this day in history, we remember, of course, one of those incidents that went terribly wrong, the Space Shuttle Challenger, which launched from Florida's Kennedy Space Center on this day in 1986. The mood, of course, leading up to that launch was full of promise that day. NASA was coming off of 9 missions the previous year. And with 12 scheduled missions in 1986, apparently they were supposed to be marking this as a banner year. This according to Valerie Neal of the National Air and Space Museum. Speaking with Smithsonian.com, she noted that this, of course, was such a huge event. It was being televised all around the country. I remember this, in fact. That was the year my little brother was born, so I was 3 years old, but well enough along to understand what was going on. I remember my mom being so upset that day. Televisions in classrooms, students across the country, everybody was watching this historic experience because, of course, there were educators involved. This was to be a teachable moment, but that teachable moment, says Neil, which was to inspire future astronauts to come, of course, became something much different.
So the 25th space shuttle mission is now on the way after more delays than NASA cares to count. This morning, it looked as though they were not going to be able to get off.
1 minute, 15 seconds. Velocity, 2,900 feet per second. Altitude, 9 nautical miles. Downrange distance, 7 nautical miles.
Looks like a couple of the solid rocket boosters blew away from the side of the shuttle in an explosion.
Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction.
Many of them probably had their view blocked just as we did with the television cameras, with just a huge fireball and a huge cloud of smoke. They may not realize yet what has happened. You see concern etched on their faces. The breath that they've been holding released. And then the realization sets in that something is wrong.
Something was wrong indeed. Now, what had happened, a rubber O-ring seal in one of the Challenger's solid rocket boosters had failed during that liftoff. And as it was taking off into the atmosphere, this caused hot gases to leak through a joint and flames to burn through the support attaching the booster to an external fuel tank. That booster then crashed into the tank. Liquid hydrogen and oxygen ignited. And just 73 seconds into the flight, the shuttle actually tore apart. The crew compartment crashed into the ocean, killing all 7 crew members. Now, that night, President Reagan, who was supposed to deliver his State of the Union, instead acted as mourner-in-chief, taking to the airwaves that night and declaring the tragedy a national loss.
They, the Challenger 7, were aware of the dangers, but overcame them and did their jobs brilliantly. We mourn 7 heroes. Michael Smith, Dick Scobie, Judith Resnick, Ronald McNair, Ellison Onizuka, Gregory Jarvis, and Krista Mikulov. We mourn their loss as a nation together.
on display in the museum's Moving Beyond Earth exhibition, according to Smithsonian.com, is a particularly poignant Challenger artifact, a commemorative plaque that NASA gave to each of the astronauts' families in the museum on the first anniversary of the disaster. And on it are the names, of course, and the portraits of Challenger's crew members, a mission patch, and a small United States flag that was recovered from debris on the ocean floor. It's hard to watch that. And going back, of course, today, preparing for this short segment on tonight's broadcast, it indeed hits you when you look at that and you think about what happened, and you're putting yourself in the place of and the minds and the hearts of those who were watching that day when the unthinkable happened.
It absolutely was unthinkable. I wasn't alive at the time, so obviously I don't remember it, but I've studied it plenty in all my years in being, you know, infatuated with space and everything NASA. And the interesting thing I found was about why the O-ring failed. You know, the O-ring stopped working below 40 degrees because they hadn't been tested below that temperature. Because, I mean, you know, the rockets are launching from Florida. It's rare that you would ever get down to below 40 degrees. But the cold snap that night dropped the temperature below 30.
Wow.
And that's when they stopped working. So that's what caused it. It's one of those things that you just never think will happen, and it does. The universe throws those strange, you know, things to you.
Yeah, we remember that pivotal point, and I think in a lot of ways a turning point in our progression outward from this planet and off into space as Team Civilization. Indeed, we remember them and their bravery, those who put their lives at risk, of course, to learn about space and the way that things occur off-planet. Speaking of things off-planet, it's also been reported recently by the Register that an amateur astronomer who was hunting for the Zuma satellite, we talked about that recently on the program, SpaceX may or may not have lost this thing, and we're not really sure what happened to it, but somebody was out there looking for it. I believe he found signals from a NASA satellite thought dead since 2005. Now, as we know, Zuma went missing after separation from its SpaceX Falcon 9 launcher earlier this month. And like many amateur sky watchers, this fellow right here included, Scott Tilley has since tried to locate that super secret satellite. There are a lot of ways you can do this that include visuals, you know, in the night sky on a clear night in your backyard, preferably a place far enough away from, you know, the contamination of city lights. But you can also utilize satellite tracking data through computers, and a lot of information is available not only online but through smartphone apps and things like that. Well, during his personal search, he began to receive signals from something he thought maybe was the possibly missing Zuma. Instead, what he ends up finding appear to have been from NASA's image, that is the Imager for Magnetopause to Aurora Global Exploration Satellite, which was pronounced dead again back in 2005. His discovery has been confirmed now by Goddard Space Flight Center. They have acknowledged that he did find what was believed to be a long deceased, at least a little more than a decade deceased satellite, and it was responding to. And this according to Tilley himself, he said, upon reviewing the data from January 20th, 2018, I noticed a curve consistent with a satellite in high Earth orbit, and this at about 2275.905 megahertz. He said, it's not Zuma, and this is not uncommon during these searches, so I set to work to try and identify what the actual source of the orbiting object was. So he believes that image is still spinning it close to its operational value with a period of around 175 seconds, and in fact, the design value was exactly that, so it still seems to be maintaining that spin. He suggests that the satellite's unnoticed revival was a classic turn-it-off-and-turn-it-back-on scenario. Image's high Earth orbit had a 90-degree inclination that regularly put it in eclipse, and that meaning, of course, that the communication system got a reboot and that eventually it woke it back up. Pretty fascinating stuff. That reminds me, by the way, you know, Lauren sent along some information for us, Matt, and Lauren's, of course, in the chat room there tonight, and this has to do with something else that may be eclipsing. That's right. We have not only a lunar eclipse that's going to be occurring soon, but also a super blue blood moon. Now, you'd probably think that if it was a blood moon, it would be red, not a blue moon. But then again, a blue moon isn't actually blue. Well, tell you the truth, sometimes a blood moon isn't actually red. Okay, if I haven't completely confused everybody just yet. The point is that what we're going to be having is a very rare event. And a lot of this has to do with the fact that with a blue moon or any other kind of a circumstance where the moon appears larger in the sky, a little brighter and altogether differently, what is occurring is essentially we have the moon, which has a slightly irregular orbit, which puts it closer to Earth at certain times. And we're going to have a rare, I would definitely say an unusual pairing of circumstances that makes this extremely worth going out and watching for. Now, Newsweek reports on this and says that in general,
They can be up to 14% bigger than apogee full moons and up to 30% brighter. The difference in size is very difficult for our eyes to discern, but the moon will probably be noticeably bright. Now, January 31st, just a couple days from the time of this broadcast, is the last time that you will have to see a supermoon this year. All you have to do is just look to the skies after sunset. You should be able to see this. But again, blue moon has come to mean the second full moon in a calendar month. January's already had one of those thus far, and hence why we have the blue moon. The blood moon refers to a lunar eclipse where the satellite will glow a spectacular red for many viewers. So that's something to be looking forward. Not a man-made satellite, but a satellite nonetheless. Earth's lonely natural satellite. And by the way, Lauren notes in her show notes that she sends along to us that the word lunatic, as we know it, comes from the Latin luna because it was believed that people were more likely to exhibit aberrant behavior during a full moon. Now, although studies have been done showing that emergency room visits and accidents are increased during the full moon period, there's yet to be any conclusive evidence for a link, a causation between these apparent phenomena. And I wonder about that. Again, I mean, are we going to see more weird phenomena coinciding with the blue blood moon? Maybe you guys will keep an eye on it. Let's get our Citizen Science Brigade involved. And those of you guys out there who are watching this, email me info@graylianreport.com, info@micahanks.com. If you hear of anything or see any reports of unusual behavior or other phenomena coinciding with that event. She also says, I spent the better half of my morning, by the way, trying to find scientific explanations for so many common moon myths and legends, but guess what? I couldn't. And I guess that's why we call them myths and legends. But hey, Lauren, you know, we enjoy them nonetheless. And indeed, mythological or actually those which are backed by science, they are fun to discuss in this context. Now, one thing that I'm a little less apt to enjoy when it comes to space mysteries is when people look at ancient archaeological things and they try to say, therefore aliens. This is, and I've had friends and colleagues over the years say, Micah, don't be so hard on the ancient astronaut theories. But again, what I want to see is hard proof of it. And again, Newsweek reporting on this, a number of news outlets reporting on a video that went viral last week, which purports to show artifacts from a cave in Mexico, and people saying that these are irrefutable evidence of extraterrestrials touching down in ancient times. Now, apparently this was associated with a YouTube account called UFO Mania. They posted this video on Thursday. It's apparently been viewed probably closing in on 150,000 times at least, but after Newsweek and other agencies report on this, it gets even more traction. Many will know the Klaus Dohna artifacts. There are tons more where they come from. More and more locals and farmers are showing their private artifacts, according to the video. Fortunately, they did not give their artifacts to the Smithsonian Institute and the like for further analysis. Now, that right there, I love it when people say things like this. Fortunately, they didn't give their artifacts away to the Smithsonian. There is this misconception in archaeological circles that groups like the Smithsonian are just going out there trying to steal everybody's artifacts. And often private collectors do not report where and what they have found because they're afraid that, quote-unquote, the government, keep in mind the Smithsonian is actually an independent federal agency, but they're afraid that, quote-unquote, the government's going to come and take all of their stuff. Now, look, I'm a licensed hobby diver in the state of South Carolina, and certain things that I may find of significance to the state archaeological scientists, they may request that I bring it in to look at it. And funny thing is actually being associated somewhat by virtue of visits and mutual research goals with certain members of the staff of the University of South Carolina at Columbia, I go down there with Jason Pentrail and the Seven Ages team, and we would be reporting this information to them anyway out of interest to aiding them in their research and also getting a certain degree of academic perspective on what we have found, and so we can also catalog it in their system. So I like maintaining this relationship. At no time are they going to try and say, we need to confiscate this. You can't have that. There may be some instances where something of great significance may catch attention and someone may be offered money for it, but I can't think of an instance where, unless it was acquired by a group like the Smithsonian, that somebody had their objects taken from them, or if they willingly gave them over, that they tried to hide proof that they existed outright. That is completely rumor and hearsay. And so this video is playing into this existing mythology of the Smithsonian secretly going around and, you know, gathering up all the giant skeletons and gathering up all the hidden treasures, gathering up all the evidence of things that actually happened in the Bible and putting them away in some sort of a storage facility. Funny thing is, see, I've talked about this over at MicahHanks.com when I initially was just interested in the old Smithsonian articles about what they called, for lack of a better term, giants. They were just talking about large bodies, You know, people have for years tried to say that there was no evidence that they were actually found. In fact, for instance, a macrocephalic skull like the Graham skull is a huge human skull, but by virtue of being macrocephalic, as identified on the accession card catalog from the Smithsonian, that may have been a very large head on a person who didn't necessarily have a very large body to match it, okay? It seemed to be a variety of a pathology. So that wasn't necessarily evidence of a giant. That was just a very large skull. But some of the skulls were also found in situ alongside bodies where a person was large too. But then again, if we're talking 6, 7, 8 feet tall, I mean, there are people in recent times who have been that tall. Robert Wadlow, according to the Guinness Book of World Records, being the tallest on record at 8'11". And so I've always said we need to set a boundary. Let's say if you pass the Wadlow test and you hit higher than 8'11", if you're 9 feet tall, I'll be impressed. I have seen no evidence of anybody that tall, ever. So that said, there is, if you want to know where these things are kept, there is an off-site storage facility where the Smithsonian does keep some of its finds. And I do think that this has probably led to some clerical errors over the years when people like Ivan Sanderson went looking for those things and that they reported at the Smithsonian that they didn't have those in their collections. They probably did exist. They probably had been, again, annotated and noted as being received when they couldn't be found in the collections. That's probably because they were in another facility. But if you go through their accession card catalog, you can find out exactly where they are. As I've done and as some colleagues of mine have done and brought to my attention in the past, I don't see a big mystery there. But the problem is that you've got conspiracy theorists who say one thing. You've got super uber skeptics who say nothing to see here at all. In the middle, usually there is some grain of truth, but it's often a very less sensational story than what either of those sides wants to try and promote it as being. I mean, again, I think if you really do good research, you'll get to the bottom of it. And that's what I've found. No, the Smithsonian's not trying to hide stuff, cover anything up. Newsweek reported on this Mexican find, though. They said this isn't the first time that theorists have suggested aliens constructed ancient Mexican objects and structures. Some extraterrestrial believers think aliens also crafted the country's holy city of Teotihuacan, a famous archaeological site. But, of course, they have no evidence to back that up. We've heard the same thing, Matt, about the Nazca lines. We've heard it about the Egyptian pyramids. Humans couldn't do it, therefore aliens, right? Now, on an upcoming edition of the Seven Ages Audio Journal, Jason Pendrell and I sit down with Dr. Bradley Lepper of the Ohio History Connection. He's one of the most prominent archaeologists in the state of Ohio. We actually talk with him a little bit about how, yes, there is a racist component to people trying to say that these things couldn't have been built by ancient people. It had to be with the help of aliens. My argument's always been, if aliens with highly advanced technology came down to Earth and built these temples, wouldn't that be, I mean, building great big stone monuments, wouldn't that be tantamount to coming down on Earth and building mud pies on a picnic and then just taking off? What would move aliens far more advanced and capable of travel through space to come down here and build stone structures and then just take off and leave?
So we would be asking these questions thousands of years later.
But Matt, that's
boom, proved.
That's what they want you to think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't know. And I almost get burnt out with even having to bring it up. The other side of this, I will say fairly, the Newsweek headline, for instance, no, ancient Mexican artifacts in a new video are not evidence of aliens visiting the Earth. And I mean, the general snarky tone that people take is what really kind of also get, you know, that really upsets me, because I believe that if you want to educate people about what is more likely than aliens building pyramids and things, you need to be able to have a constructive dialogue with people. We try to do that on this show. Some people prefer just to engage in ad hominem attacks of others, which does nothing to further dialogue nor educate. And in fact, I would say that that kind of negative skepticism is actually harmful to the promotion of good science. But moving on to more important things, we have also talked about on the Seven Ages Audio Journal recently the sordid history of one of the most famous known names in crime in America, and that, of course, Charles Manson. Matt, I know that you have been fascinated with Charles Manson for a long time. When we come back from this break, I have a very bizarre update about the body of Charles Manson. I don't know if you've been following this, but you know, you'll hear about these kind of things. I know Matt, of course, he just digested the book, Helter Skelter. He's an avid reader. I am an avid reader. I know that a lot of people in the audience of this program love to read. And we also talk about technology a lot on this program, and I think that's one reason why audiobooks are so important right now. They're also great for helping people, and I think that they can help you be a better you, whether you want to feel healthier, get motivated, or try and learn something new. You see, a great book that I actually own an audiobook version of is The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss. Now, that book is really instrumental to me, because whether or not you can actually cram a work week into 4 hours, although I would say that more work is completed in around 4 hours in relation to this show that we do every week than most would probably do in a full work week. Yeah, it's pretty busy. But I mean, I learned a lot from reading the 4-Hour Work Week, and it's available. Another great one, by the way. If you actually are more interested in ancient mysteries like what we've been talking about, you might check out Graham Hancock's Magicians of the Gods, which, if I remember correctly, Graham reads that himself in a very lovely English accent. If you've met Graham or heard him online, he's a wonderful orator, and he reads his own book. Now, Audible is where you can find so many of these fantastic books, and Audible's content includes an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more from the leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, magazines, and newspaper publishers, even business information providers. Now, you can download and listen on your iOS device, your Android, Amazon Fire tablets, and unlike a streaming or rental service, with Audible, you own your books. Plus, they have a great listen guarantee. If you didn't like it, you can swap it. So right now, Audible is offering listeners of this program a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. All you have to do is go to audible.com/TGR, as in the Graylian Report, or text TGR to 500-500 to get started and browse their incredible selection of audio programs. Just download a title for free and start listening. It's really that easy. Go to audible.com/TGR or text TGR to 500-500. Again, that's audible.com/TGR or text TGR to 500-500. You can do it with audiobooks. I know I have, and I think you guys certainly will too. Now, when we come back again, in addition to this Charles Manson update that we have, we've got some other news too. Some of it of the blood-sucking variety, but I may not be talking about vampires, or am I? That reminds me of a hilarious film that was recommended to me recently. We might have to touch on that too. Oh, so much to do and so little time. It is the Graylian Report.
From the swamps of the LaRue Bayou to the depths of the Graylian Bunker, it's former WCW and WWE professional wrestler, the Raging Cajun, Lash LaRue, and you are listening to my friend and my brother, Micah Hanks, on the Graylian Report. Ha ha!
The high mountains of Appalachia, it is the Graylian Report. Welcome back. I am Micah Hanks, along with Matthew Oakley. Glad, as always, to be here with you guys. Hey, quick shout-out to Grimstake there in the chat room. Always good to see him. Oh, and look, James Waldo's hiding. Well, he's hanging out and hiding out, so I'll give him a little of both. Yes, indeed. Matt, was there a question, did you say?
Yes. It appears one of our listeners would like to know how you account for Puma Punku.
Okay, Puma Punku is interesting. I'll tell you this. Again, what they're referring to probably are the markings that we see on Puma Punku, which is actually a part of a larger complex but recognizes the Temple of the Sun. It is interesting, and there are a lot, well, not just markings. I mean, a lot of it has to do with the actual structural aspects too. Graham Hancock in Fingerprints of the Gods, for instance, talks about how fascinating it is. I've looked at Puma Punku also. I know Graham doesn't go so far as to say what ancient astronaut theorists say, which is that this had to have been lasers that did this. I don't prescribe to the laser theory, but I'll tell you something interesting. His name is Christopher Dunn. He's the engineer who went and looked at the Egyptian pyramids. I believe he's traveled down to South America and looked at some of the structures there too. He believes that there were technologies that existed in ancient times and that this involved essentially a variety of ancient power tool. But now let me qualify that statement. I don't know that we would call these quote-unquote power tools like a Dremel tool or something that's powered by the Baghdad battery or something like that. We don't see evidence of things like that. But I'll tell you this, when you comb through the archives of you know, books like William R. Corliss's Science Frontiers, you know, Science Sourcebook projects, you do see a lot of references to what sometimes are taken to be evidence of high technology in ancient times. Simple examples of that are known to exist include the Antikythera mechanism that was found along with a shipwreck off of the island of Antikythera near Greece, which is very clearly an ancient analog computer. It was used to probably map celestial things that were happening and was likely used for navigational purposes. There are references throughout history to things that, and I've written about this too, that resemble telescopes. And that has always really fascinated me, because even Copernicus was said to have believed that there were in likelihood telescopes that were used by the ancients. I don't know why he would have thought that, unless he too had read references to magic mirrors and things that were described that allowed a person to be able to see an advancing army miles away and make them look like they were much closer. You do hear references to things like this. So I kind of find that sort of thing interesting, but I also wonder sometimes about some of the claims as far as power tools. I think, again, if we're going to look at and or liken any of the structures or the carvings or the architecture of the ancient world to having any kind of outward evidence of, you know, modern-esque tools, we really need to understand that they probably were capable of highly, I think that there were degrees of ingenuity that they were capable of, which created results on par with things we would see with modern tools, but they probably weren't using anything akin to modern tools. In fact, there may have been technologies that were being utilized that we simply haven't any kind of a historical record for. They may involve perishable materials, so there isn't any kind of a remnant of these. We may go on to find evidence of exactly how this was done. We may find some sort of an archaeological dig that where there is a preserved component, and we can actually find clues or maybe even answers to how these structures were built, like Pumapunku and things like that. But I don't, again, look at that and say, well, they couldn't have done this in ancient times. Aliens must have done this. There's no evidence I've ever seen of that. I definitely think, however, though, that even some modern scholars undermine the capabilities and the ingenuity of ancient people and thinkers. They were probably capable of far more than we give them credit for. And, you know, it's interesting because I saw a recent reconstruction. Lauren sent this to me and a few others too. A reconstruction of the face, the facial characteristics of a girl from Greece who would have lived around 9,000 years ago. And when you look at her face and you look into her eyes, the first thing you notice is, my gosh, she looks just like a girl you'd meet on the street today. 16 years old. She looks like an average, 16-year-old. 9,000 years ago. And 9,000 years before that, and 9,000 years earlier before that, and 9,000 years earlier before that, people essentially, anatomically, were just like modern humans today then, too. And you could go even further back than that. I mean, we as the species we recognize, Homo sapiens, we've existed for a long time. The brain capacity of our ancestors in those ancient times was essentially what it is today. We may not have had the accumulation of knowledge that we have, you know, built onto for centuries and have at our disposal now, but I mean, people had all the capacities for intelligence and ingenuity, and if they saw a problem, again, they were capable of coming to terms with that and being very creative in finding ways to overcome those difficulties in the ancient world. And hence you see the architecture of the Inca. You see the landmark buildings and structures on the Giza Plateau. You see the incredible structures in parts of Indonesia and in places all around the world, and even like some of the ones I visited over the weekend when I was down there at the Okmulgee National Monument in Georgia. You see a 55-foot-high earthen mound with a flat top that has a perimeter that's about 250 feet by 300 feet. I mean, it's massive. And people in the Mississippian period built this thing. I mean, it just blows your mind. I got to tell you, Dakota and I, we were just awestruck as we were walking up the hill and coming up on what's called the Great Temple Mound. Just breathtaking stuff. So yeah, people in ancient time, they were capable of incredible things. Now, getting back to the news here, because I do want to touch on this story, Matt. The battle over Charles Manson's body. Have you been following this at all?
I've seen the stories. I haven't really followed it to any great length or anything like that, but I do see that apparently several people have come forward to claim the body, apparently, and they're having court cases to determine which county the claims should go to, because he spent most of his life in prison in one county and then died actually in another county while in the hospital. So there's a lot of back and forth, legal back and forth going on around this. And apparently part of it has to do with the possibility that somebody might actually sell the body for profit, or even trim off some of his tattoos and try and sell them.
Oh, boy. That's what's kind of concerning, because you remember back in the days of the saints, and they would sell the finger of the Apostle Paul. Yeah. They would sell a splinter from the cross that Christ was crucified on. I don't want to see Charles Manson relics on the black market, the tattooed arm or...
Well, and there's a huge market for this kind of stuff. During the break, I was pulling up, it's called Murderabilia, and this stuff goes for a lot of money. You hear about Johnny Depp owning John Wayne Gacy's painting and,
who would want to have a painting by John Wayne Gacy? I wouldn't want that within a mile of my house, let alone on the wall in my hallway.
Allegedly, Depp got rid of it because it creeped him out too much.
Imagine that.
Yeah, right.
You don't say.
But there's some, I just pulled up 10 disturbing items sold, right? The first one that pulls up are the envelopes of the BTK killer, right? And
talk about a creep.
Oh, yeah.
This guy, for folks who don't know at home, the BTK killer had been teaching Sunday school for years while, of course, as I remember correctly, he had been kidnapping and torturing young women in a murder dungeon, which I think was somewhere
else. It was blind torture killer was the BTK.
Right.
They're horrible murders, and he would write letters, and there's one where he drew a picture of what he called Factor X, the creature who apparently made him kill. And that picture was on sale for $3,000, or you could get the envelope that had actually been licked by Dennis Radar, the killer, for $325 for an envelope.
But there are people who'll pay that.
Yeah, an autograph from Albert Fish went for $30,000.
Mm-hmm.
The one I found just astonishing was that apparently a descendant or relative of Jack Ruby sold his Colt Cobra, and that went for $220,000.
That was presumably the gun that was used to kill Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah, yeah.
Incredible. Well, with this story, I'm going to read from a New York Post article here briefly because...
Well, I was real quick just to interject there. Manson is on here as well, and a lock of his hair was going for $800. Even recently.
I'm surprised it wasn't going for more than that. Now, in a hearing that was planned to determine the venue for legal battles over Manson's estate and, yes, of course, the disposition of his remains for any number of reasons, as we've already outlined, Jason Freeman, whose father was born by Manson's first wife, echoed the frustration of several parties who have been trying to get control of the notorious criminal's body since he died in November. My grandfather, he says, has been on ice for over 60 days. And he blurts this out in court, apparently choking up. Before he died, Manson had even, in recent years, married a young woman. He said it was all for show, but she said that, she believed in justice, that he'd never killed anybody. He had an incredible ability over the years, even in recent years, to influence people, just as he had done immediately prior to the Tate and LaBianca murders. Judge David Cowan divided the two dueling Manson cases that are ongoing right now, deciding that litigation over the potentially lucrative estate should remain in Los Angeles because that's where Manson was living when he was arrested and convicted of the murders of the pregnant actress Sharon Tate and eight others. Now, Cowan said that the case over the remains, however, belongs to either Kings County, where the cult leader was imprisoned, or in Kern County, where he died at age 83 at a Bakersfield hospital. A hearing is already scheduled Wednesday in Bakersfield, and the Kern County coroner, who has the body, requested that the case be decided there. But actually, they mentioned two cases. Here's the thing. There are three parties right now who have apparently staked their claims, Matt, in court to try and collect Manson's body from the morgue and take control of any existing assets, which could include rights to any property he left behind. Now, the commercial right to use his image or royalties to songs he wrote would be among these. Guns N' Roses recorded one of his songs called Look at Your Game Girl. And more famously, the Beach Boys, of course, had recorded a tune which was called, what was that?
Without Love? What was it?
No, it was, Yeah, I think that Brian Wilson changed the name of it to that, but Manson had given it a different name. So anyway, the rights to those songs may come up with this also. Interesting. A lot of questions, nonetheless, but one of the most infamous people who didn't actually kill anybody himself but was nonetheless convicted of those murders spent life in jail. Now there's this dispute over his remains.
Yeah, and you have to wonder, because there is precedent for trying to get a body of a famous person to try and garner the you know, inheritance or estate or whatever. I actually think immediately back to Graham Parsons. You know, it was alleged that his stepfather went out to try and get the body of his estranged stepson, who he never approved of, never liked, or any of that, and tried to get the body brought back home to, I believe, Alabama to have him buried in a family plot, so that would give him the rights to the estate afterwards. You know, people do some manipulative things with the deceased, and it's horrifying and disgusting.
Yeah, James Waldo there in the chat room said, I'm sure there's somebody that would take his body and have it taxidermied and mounted in their den. James, you're probably spot on, buddy. That's what's so terrifying. You know, speaking of jailbirds, by the way, for 29 years, the famous prison known as Alcatraz was one of the most secure federal prisons in the country. So famous, of course, that, well, you can go and you can tour it today, and there was a famous film made about it, but it wasn't just about the film, or rather about the prison itself. It was about three inmates who escaped, and those men, the brothers John and Clarence Anglin and Frank Morris, it's truly one of those legendary tales. Now, the film ends with the men trying to escape. One of them, of course, yes, played by Clint Eastwood. And it leaves it kind of open to suggestion whether they made it alive across the harbor. But there have long been shreds of evidence that have turned up over the years, which some believe are suggestive that the men did survive their attempt and that they did escape and may have, much like the Nazis after the war, fled to South America. That's right. Now, San Francisco CBS affiliates report that the men have become folklore fueled by Hollywood and popular shows. And in the last 55 years, a number of theories about their fate have multiplied as new evidence surfaces. There is a recent piece of evidence which has been put forth that some say is maybe not conclusive, but the strongest yet, that shows that the men probably did escape. This letter, allegedly written by one of the escapees, has come to light. And it reads in part, "My name is John Anglin. I escaped from Alcatraz in June 1962 with my brother Clarence and with Frank Morris. I'm 83 years old and I'm in bad shape. I have cancer. Yes, we all made it that night, but barely." Now, the FBI says this is the most recent piece of evidence that forced the agency to reopen the iconic cold case. And you thought, Matt, probably this was going to have to do with D.B. Cooper. The letter was sent to San Francisco Police Department's Richmond Station in 2013. And there's apparently a History Channel documentary that is going to be, or has aired recently, which discusses this. Now, according to a security analyst named Jeff Harp, he says, it's interesting. I mean, it's obviously a very famous case here in San Francisco. And he says, as a law enforcement person, I'd like to think that their escape attempt was not fruitful for them. Personally, as someone who swims in the bay, and we have a triathlon that goes on every year, there's not a single person that doesn't make that swim. So, in other words, it's not impossible. And perhaps this letter is evidence of that. But there have been other things, too, including a photograph that surfaced that showed, allegedly, the brothers in South America. And a person who said that he knew them who ran into him while he was there and took their photograph. I don't know what the determinations may show as far as forensic analysis of that photograph, what that might determine. But again, it's long been held that these fellows probably did escape and also that they did survive. I want to turn gears backward in time once again to ancient times. And speaking of gears, well, this has actually more to do with mathematics. So it's not quite the Antikythera mechanism, but nonetheless something that would have been fascinating to the ancient Greeks, because for nearly 2,400 years, according to some estimates, what's known as the golden ratio has fascinated mathematicians and scientists. And actually, to quote an astrophysicist who's weighed in on this, Mario Livio, he says that, quote, some of the greatest mathematical minds of all ages, from Pythagoras to Euclid in ancient Greece, through the medieval Italian mathematician Leonardo of Pisa and the Renaissance astronomer Johannes Kepler, to present-day scientific figures such as Oxford physicist Roger Penrose, have spent endless hours over this simple ratio and its properties. But the fascination with the golden ratio, as it's known, is not confined just to mathematics or mathematicians. Biologists, artists, musicians, historians, architects, psychologists, and even mystics have pondered and debated the basis of its ubiquity and appeal. In fact, It is probably fair to say that the golden ratio has inspired thinkers of all disciplines like no other number in the history of mathematics. That, again, Mario Livio. Now, IFL Science has recently reported on this, talking about that ongoing mystery. Why does the golden ratio, as it's known, appear so much in nature? And they write, there are two main discussion areas when it comes to the so-called golden ratio in nature, Fibonacci numbers and what are called golden spirals. The Fibonacci numbers form a sequence, and hence the term the Fibonacci sequence, where each number is the sum of the two preceding ones. And so the sequence would go like this, 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, 34. I think you get the drill. The ratio of two neighboring Fibonacci numbers is an approximation of the golden ratio. Petals and leaves on plants are often found in this distribution, although not every plant behaves like this, so we can't claim that it's a universal property. The golden spiral also often emerges in this argument. Both the Romanesco broccoli, if you've ever seen that, by the way, it is absolutely incredible. And also the shell of the nautilus follow regular spiral structures, but neither really follow the traditional golden spiral. And such a spiral is created by increasing the spiral's radius by the golden proportion every 90 degrees. The shell of the nautilus in particular can be better described as having a spiral that expands by the golden ratio every 180 degrees. And even this is still an approximation. If plants want to maximize the exposure their leaves have to the sun, for example, they ideally need to grow them at non-repeating angles. I mean, I'm thinking probably a lot of people have never really thought about why and how the leaves are distributed along the stem of a plant. But again, having an irrational value guarantees this, so the spirals we see in nature are a consequence of this behavior. All these distributions follow logarithmic spirals and general mathematical form of a golden spiral. So getting down to brass tacks, or maybe we should say golden tacks in this case, what really is the meaning at the end of the day? The general gist, according to IFL Science, is that nature is lazy and wants to do the least amount of work for the maximum result. The simplest way to do this is by giving simple instructions like first grow, then turn a certain angle, and grow again. I don't know if I'd call that laziness, though. I think that's a misappropriation of terminology. I would prefer to say rather than lazy, I would say efficiency. Nature is efficient.
You certainly are a wordsmith, sir.
Well, not everyone thinks so. But in my own mind, at least in my own shower, I certainly am. Mathematically, this is better described by fractals, repetitive patterns that can end up producing logarithmic spirals. But it also is important to remember that from the point of view of physics, spirals are low-energy configurations. See, once again, if they're talking about low-energy configurations, it stands to reason to me that rather than lazy, this is one of the issues I have with IFL Science, by the way, their use of terms and things. These days, if you try to word things eloquently, people either don't understand what you're saying, they will say that they can understand what you're saying, or they will criticize you for your choice in wording because they want you to speak, well, basically in a way that every 16 or 17-year-old in high schools will be able to read it. And again, not to disparage our 16 and 17-year-olds in high schools, because many of those little language scholars in our high schools, some of them in their English honors class like I was in all throughout high school, they're probably better at their terminology and word usage than those who would criticize others for their terminology and word usage. But I digress. The point I'm making is that you read books from 100 years ago and look how people wrote. I love, at times, a little, you know, florid language. I love beautifully written language and use of words that are at times a bit esoteric. Now, you can go overboard with it, but again, to call nature lazy, nature is efficient, and there is a beauty to its efficiency. That's, I think, a better, more tasteful, and frankly, a more accurate way of terming that. So anyway, I'm just nitpicking here, but I do like seeing beauty in nature, and if you look for it, you'll see beauty in all things. At least that's my philosophy. When we return, I want to look at a very beautiful subject and also the beautiful mind of a man who tried to apply science to it, that is cryptozoology. We will return here on the Graylian Report.
You're listening to the KGRA Digital Broadcasting Station, Van Buren, Arkansas, Sarasota, Florida.
the Grailian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grailian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com, our home on the darkest corner of the web. I am Micah Hanks, along with Matthew Oakley, Grace Hobbo Hobbs, the lovely assistant Lauren, and the entire Grailian gang. It is the Grailian Report. Glad to have all you guys here in pocket with us for a couple of hours, as we do every Monday night, making sense of the madness that makes its way through our minds and sometimes our hearts. You know, a little heart-wrenching story for later on. We're going to be talking about a true loss in the field of cryptozoology, someone who has tried to apply not just science, but philosophy and philosophy of science to subjects like mystery animals and their alleged existence. I can always appreciate the philosophers of science and some good skepticism, some balanced inquiry, but also open-mindedness in the pursuit of scientific knowledge. That's definitely something we're going to be looking at and remembering. A true icon in the field who did so over the weekend. You know, Matt and I, we were delving into some missing person cases, too. That's another subject I'm equally passionate about. And if you're not already a subscriber to Grailian X, you can get access to shows like that by heading over to GrailianReport.com/X. You can sign up today. It's very easy to do. $7 a month or $77 a year. And, of course, there's all kinds of additional content. We will be putting out a new episode of Grailian Enigmas here in just a few days also. And if you are interested in podcasts, you like what you hear on shows like this, and you want to get in there, get your game on, you know, put your head in the ring and try it yourself, like the Grimstake did there in the chat room. I mean, he is my official minister of mugs in the world's most secret society, and also a good friend, does a fantastic job with his podcast, Cruising Mistake. A lot of people have learned the ropes in part. I can't take credit for the fine work that guys like Grim do, but a lot of people have learned the ropes in part due to the book that I wrote about this called The Complete Guide to Maverick Podcasting. And actually at GrailianReport.com, if you scroll down the page, right over there on the right-hand side of the page, you'll see a link that shows the book and says Podcast Like a Pro. And you can get that book as easy as 1, 2, 3. Just head over to GrailianReport.com. Check it out. I do think that if you are interested in becoming a podcaster, you should. And I'm always happy to make appearances on people's shows, too. If you're somebody who's bought the book, you're doing a podcast, don't hesitate to reach out. I think a lot of people are like, oh, he's too busy, because you hear me say I'm busy on this show all the time. Yeah, sometimes I am busy, and I'm not always able to get back to an email from somebody immediately. But if people, I always want to support my brothers and sisters in the podcasting community. And so as not to discriminate, those life forms which may not identify as male or female and may not be earthling, in fact, in the listening audience, I think there are a few of those out there, too. We are an interdimensional broadcast. That's right. And so we always want to feature you guys, and I'm happy to hear from anyone who has obtained a copy of that book. info@micahanks.com. Drop me a line if you've got a question, comment, or anything like that. A lot of you guys do that already, including Corey Card, who writes and says, hello, Micah. It's been a while since I last wrote. I hope you're doing well. Hey, I'm doing great. I can't complain. He says, like many others, I've had a busy holiday season, and I was only recently able to get caught up on a few weeks' worth of Grailian Report episodes. I had occasion to listen to your December 5th, 2017 episode where you and Matt spoke at length in regard to the targeting extinction effort for malaria carrying strains of mosquitoes. And at one point during your dialogue with Matt, one of you mentioned how this sort of language of purposefully targeting species for their extinction is a recent phenomenon, and that we as a society have become desensitized to such ideas. But really, in truth, this conversation has been going on in medicine for a while. I was in my professional sequence at a medical laboratory as a medical laboratory scientist 6 years ago when, during a parasitology class, we discussed at length the targeted eradication of the Guinea worm. And I believe that the name here, and he includes that here, he said, in short, the Dracunia culiacis is a worm that has historically caused much suffering and ill health in Africa, and the targeted eradication effort has reduced the cases of the disease to approximately 30 over the past 2 years, down from several million at the turn of the 21st century. So while the point of downstream consequences in regard to eradicating something like a mosquito are legitimate concerns and must be carefully studied, I think a concrete positive example of the practice is warranted. Thanks for your time, Corey Card, MLS ASCP. And Corey, thank you for writing too. Again, I'm always so happy to hear from our friends out there in the audience who are members of the body scientific, the scientific community. You know, for all the haters, for all the complainers, for all the people who want to leave negative reviews on iTunes and people who say that, you know, they don't like the subjects we address on this program, I have more people who are qualified professional scientists that write into the program and interact with me on a frequent basis than any other demographic in the listenership. More scientists listen to this program and write to me and engage me directly than any other group of people employed in any profession that I can think of. People who work in government may be second to that. And for that, I'm very thankful because, in my opinion, your opinion matters. I love to hear from qualified members of the scientific community. That's why I work with two of them, James Waldo and Jason Pentrail. But I digress. One of my favorite human beings to ever walk the earth wrote in recently to Samantha, and she wrote in, and I got to put on echo for this, the way that she writes it. She and I have this thing. We say, Micah. Hi. Hello, Samantha. How are you? I've been trying to catch up on all the Graylian shows. Life has been so crazy, I wasn't able to keep up for the past few months like I normally was able to. But anyway, I'm catching up now. And today I was listening to your episode from January 8th. You were talking about the segment with Stephen Colbert and Neil deGrasse Tyson. I found all this so intriguing. And I was laughing about Matt closing his eyes and you telling him he looked like a frog that was eating. She says, I totally understood what you meant. Sorry, Matt.
It's okay. It's always at my expense, isn't it?
That's right. Because that's right. Think about how much joy you bring to the world when and people envision you going like this. Yeah. See, people
at least one person smiling.
Samantha is smiling. So with this interstellar object slingshotting around the sun, she says, this made me think of those videos I've seen of some kind of enormous object caught on tape near the sun doing what would look like refueling. Have you seen these videos? Just monstrous, what I assume to be craft, and it literally looks like they're sucking plasma from the sun or something onto the ship. Here's a link to the story. There are many videos out there. I'm sure you've seen these before, but this whole conversation made me wonder, what if, yes, they are slingshotting around the sun, and maybe they're refueling. Maybe in order to refuel properly, they don't turn their engines on. I do agree that probably they're not using actual engines if they're that advanced, but right, maybe they refuel and then just coast. They just kick back, refuel on Sundays, and coast through our galaxy, a little refueling vacation. Anyway, I just wanted to share this thought with you, still loving the show more than ever, and I had another dream about you last month. So we were at a pub drinking green beverages and having great conversations. It was fun, and I hope to talk to you soon, Micah. Samantha, indeed, I hope the same, and here's all the best to you, your family, and the little one. By the way, I've seen the pictures on Instagram, and indeed, that little Bebo is adorable.
Let's clarify, though. I'm the one who drinks absinthe, not Micah.
That's true, yeah. I leave the green fairy to Matt. Race Hobbs and I, although we do have a green beverage that we drink, it has a slightly different name. It's called the Juggle Green. Celso writes, Micah, I reread the New York Times article about the AATIP. This is, of course, is the advanced... Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. You know, that thing, the Pentagon UFO program. So he says, reread the NYT article. There's no mention about the classification of the program. They do mention that spending $22 million out of $600 billion is a great way to keep things hidden in plain sight, and how later in the program, Senator Harry Reid wanted to make the program a restricted special access program. But I haven't found any definitive proof that the program was ever a top secret program. I'm bringing this to your attention because I've seen on various websites that mention that the program is highly classified or top secret UFO ID program, when in reality, we, the UFO community, need to calm down and take a step back from the hoopla that is this revelation. I believe that this revelation is helpful, but needs to be taken with a grain of salt. No results of the program have been released, to my knowledge, and from what I have gathered from the New York Times article, there are still parts of the program that are classified. However, again, no mention of the level of classification of that information. For all we know, it could be classified as sensitive and just a minor roadblock to any Freedom of Information Act requests for this data. Using the term top secret in a sense glorifies or even justifies people's reactions regarding their mistrust of government. But I believe there are other issues that we should look at as grounds for not trusting the government. Although calling the program top secret sure does make for sensational headlines, I completely agree. Again, if this were anything top secret, there would be extreme problems with Luis Elizondo going out there, releasing the footage through To the Stars Media and talking about it with the New York Times. And all the mention of him sitting with his back up against a wall looking, you know, around the room like he's very... I mean, he probably was legitimately concerned about certain information that he might put out, and he's obviously been careful about what he said, but I will also point out that he is, well, listed as a speaker at the International UFO Congress this year. I'd love to talk with him. I'm not sure if I'm going to make it or not. I'm still debating whether I'm going to go out there. I'm really thinking seriously about going to the International UFO Congress. But my good pals, again, friends in the podcasting community, Gigi, my brother, and Cortana, Empress. I was corrected the other night. Not Princess. Sorry, Cortana. Empress of all the known universe. Yes, indeed. She and Gigi are trying to get me to come out there, and I'd love to because, you know, I need a couple of companions on board the TARDIS when I'm doing my doctor thing. Salso writes also on a similar topic, I noticed a minor hiccup in the Joe Rogan interview with Tom DeLonge. Ah, Matt.
Just the minor hiccup?
Yeah. He says, in the interview, Tom mentions that he had read several books and was able to connect the dots, which led him to the conclusion and eventual contact with the people he had contacted. However, Joe didn't pursue this line of questioning to find out what books he'd read and connect the dots.
And it's obvious that Tom DeLonge has not read any books, right?
Why is that?
I'm just kidding. It was just a joke.
He has read some books. And in fact, I think I know of an interview where he mentioned some of them. I'm going to throw a pin at you, man. Stop it. Okay. Is there any chance, he said, you can find out what books helped DeLonge on his connection and possibly publish the list? That way the rest of us can see if we can find the same path that he did. Okay, Matt. We have our new mission objective. Celso's given it to us. We need to go to the UFO Congress. We need to take Luis Elizondo aside and say, sir, we just need 5 minutes of your time, please. This is of great importance. What were the books that Tom DeLonge read that led him to you? But I mean, I'm not making a lot of the matter. I mean, he does mention that he's read books. Celso, if you look up the interview that Tom did with my good friends and colleagues, Maureen Ellsbury and Jason McClellan, on Spacing Out, which was one of the Open Minds Enterprises. If you look at that video, he does talk about some of the researchers and some of the books that he's read. He mentions some of Joseph P. Farrell's books. He mentions Thomas Townsend Brown. He mentions a lot of other people. But you can get an idea for some of the subjects that and the books that he's read from that interview. Maybe not all of them, but that very well could help, and that's a good point. If you look at the kinds of books that he was reading, you might at least get into Tom DeLonge's head. Because as we know from his appearance on Joe Rogan, he didn't have all that much to say. It was kind of more like Joe would ask him a question and he would say, I can't really talk about that.
Over and over and over again. I just have one question. If we make it out to the UFO Congress to try and complete this mission that you've put forth, can we wear fake mustaches?
You don't need a fake mustache. You've got like a real mustache and a beard.
I'll put it on top of it.
Oh, a mustache on top of a mustache?
Yeah.
Hmm.
I figured it wasn't necessary.
I never thought about that. Yeah. That's kind of like we'd look like the Beastie Boys in that Sabotage video.
Yeah.
That could be cool, yeah. Or not. More like not, but maybe I could see it being cool in an alternate dimension. Tracy writes, Eve. Actually, night. Never used that one before, night. But I know what you mean, Tracy. Just sharing that I, too, am apparently a periodic biphasic sleeper and found your piece on different sleep patterns very interesting and comforting. Well, I have to say right off the bat, you got to thank the lovely assistant Lauren for that because she put together that wonderful segment that we featured, and it helped me come to terms with my own sleep pattern. This coming from the guy who woke up at 3:30 this morning, sat and read for a little while, and went back to sleep. I didn't do it for long, though. I was trying to force myself to go back to sleep, but I'm kind of learning not to force myself to do that, which kind of sucks because people will from time to time say to me, we're going to put you to sleep, man. We're going to get you some meds or something and make sure that you get a good night's sleep and everything and get your body back on a sleeping schedule. I'm like, I think my body is on a sleeping schedule. It's called a biphasic sleeping schedule. I don't think there's anything weird about that. Certain people have different sleep schedules. And thankfully, most of the time, my body allows my sleep schedule not to mess up my ability to function, because unfortunately I like to get up early, but it is hard to get up early. I'll go to bed at like 10:45 sometimes, but I'm awake at 1 o'clock and then I'm up half the night. So I do need to be able to have a schedule where it's conducive to being this kind of a sleeper. Now, Tracy says, I was diagnosed as depressed about a decade ago and swallowed the Kool-Aid about serotonin depletion, yada, yada, and dutifully took the little white pills that promised happiness and fulfillment. But actually, I was in a bad fit marriage, and as soon as I removed myself from that situation, I did exactly as I was told not to do. I quit taking those little chemical storms, cold turkey without physician supervision or advice, and I'm fine. But I digress. Hey, watch out. That's my line. I want to make a comment about antidepressants here in just a second, too, because I've gotten a lot of feedback from people about the discussion of that on this program, but I'll save that for a moment. So Tracy says, I find that I still enter a biphasic sleep cycle several times a year. It lasts usually about 2 weeks or so, and I've always found it maddening. I've tried many remedies such as melatonin, sleepy time tea, even Tylenol PM. Now, the melatonin, as many say, gives me crazy, vivid, and even disturbing nightmares that linger in my psyche for days. The tea, although it's tasty, does nothing to promote sleep. I've found that too, by the way, chamomile, stuff like that. You know, I might as well just sit there and drink beer or even coffee. It would be about as effective. The Tylenol, again, I'm kind of fond of my liver. So hearing your approach about embracing this time and taking advantage of the silence to focus on myself was an aha moment. I tried it last night, and it was wonderful. I woke up. I didn't even look at the time. I just got up, stretched for a few minutes. I turned on a soft light, grabbed a book, read for a couple hours until I was peacefully drawn back into slumber. When my alarm went off at 6:30, I awoke feeling refreshed and not at all stressed or grumpy about waking in the wee hours. It was blissful. So you have my gratitude, good sir. My gosh, I'm so happy to hear that. Lauren, I think you're still there in the chat room, Lauren. This is such an inspiring story. Look what you did. And Tracy says, you do not, however, have my gratitude for introducing me to Rocco's Basilisk. Now I'm doomed to know some future creation of myself shall face a life of torture unless I change my career and devote my intellectual efforts into developing superintelligent AI. Oh well, change is good. Sweet dreams and even sweeter awakenings, Tracy. Adam, I'm blaming you. I'm just kidding. My brother Adam Olson is the one who brought that to my attention, and Olson's right there in the chat room too. I'm so blessed, by the way, to get emails like that from people, and even more blessed to have incredible people like Adam and like the lovely assistant Lauren and Matt and all you guys who take time to interact with me on a weekly basis. But I'm especially happy to hear that someone who heard us talking about the different sleep patterns on this program, that they were helped through the stress and the anxiety that often comes with feeling like you didn't get a good night's sleep. And I'm the same way, Tracy. When I wake up and I'm laying there awake at night, if I try to lay there and go back to sleep, I start worrying about the work I've got to do the next day. And then I don't go to sleep. And I've found that if I get up and I embrace it and I actually read for a little while, I enjoy the hell out of just in having silence. My phone isn't ringing at that time of night. I can actually focus on what I'm reading. I naturally get tired from reading, go back to sleep. I can wake up at 8:30, 9, whatever, 7 even. You know, I can get up early and I can feel great. And I don't think you necessarily have to have, you know, a full night of sleep. You just need to be able to have some sleep and some rest. Remember the story we talked about last week with the boy who tried not sleeping for like 11 days? Parts of his brain were resting even while he was awake. And I think that, again, part of getting a good night's rest may just involve resting. But I'm sure that there are other sleep studies that talk about that. Now, really quickly, and then one more email that's going to segue us into the next segment about cryptozoology. I do want to point out that my pal Amy and a few others had written to me, and they'd said, Micah, you know, it's fine for you to point out that there are concerns about people taking antidepressants for things like inability to sleep and other things that don't really seem to have to do with depression. But Amy pointed out to me, she said, do please, when you're talking about that, point out that some people who suffer from clinical depression can indeed find some satisfaction and can be helped by prescription antidepressants. That's absolutely true. If the antidepressants are prescribed for the right reason, I mean, I'm absolutely not against them. What I'm against are people who are not depressed or who are not going in to talk to their doctors for that kind of symptom and who are being nonetheless prescribed mood-altering antidepressants. I have an issue with that, but if a person actually feels that they need them, and I've spoken to many people, personal friends who over the years have always talked about how, you know, again, in a proper diagnosis and prescription circumstance, they can be very helpful. Absolutely. I am a fan of medical science. I am a fan of what science teaches us about human behavior and how we can remedy problems when they arise, but the problem I see with certain medications is their prescription when there is not a system or a setting or a circumstance where a person is afflicted with what that medication is described or designed to do. Now, I understand also that I'm not a pharmacologist. I'm not a medical doctor or a psychiatrist or a psychiatric professional. I don't prescribe drugs to people, and I understand that there are nuances to the prescription of these medications that probably go well beyond my purview. So when we talk about these things on this program, keep in mind also that a lot of those things are just my opinion, but I also know of people who have felt that they had problems from the prescriptions of medications when they didn't feel that they needed one, and they frankly said, I didn't go to the doctor to get doped up on pills. I went to the doctor to find out why I wasn't sleeping at night. Maybe at very least, circumstances like what we discuss here, where you actually accept a different kind of a sleep pattern, and maybe that will work for you. Maybe that is a better alternative for some people. But again, I'm not some sort of a professional. We joke about doctors and reverends on this program. Matt's not a reverend. I'm not a doctor, certainly not. That's a nickname the listeners of this program gave me, and I embrace it for fun and as a pop culture sci-fi reference, nothing more. Now, one more email here, which is going to get us into the next section here. Dave Schaus, a new listener, writes, Mike, I'm a new listener to the Gray Alien Report. I found my way here via Jim Harold and his interview with you on the cruise ship several months ago. Great podcast, and the show's entertaining, and you are enjoyable, knowledgeable, and humorous to listen to. I have a suggestion, and I hope that you will take a moment on an upcoming show to say a few words about the passing of Dr. John Bindernagel. He was a legendary figure in the Sasquatch research field, and he's notable because he is one of the very few, truthfully, the only one that I'm aware of, respected, educated scientist with a PhD in wildlife biology that stuck his neck out amidst ridicule and small-minded, scientific, petty discrediting assault for taking an honest and legitimate look with hard research and an open-minded yet skeptical scientific view of the facts and evidence surrounding the Sasquatch phenomenon. By the way, David, I just got to say, or Dave, that you worded it perfectly. All of what you said there summarizes Bindernagel perfectly in my mind. And sadly, he died last Wednesday of cancer. Now, there are a lot of YouTube videos where you can see his work in the field. He was a very rare thing in the Bigfoot research world, a genuinely nice, kind, and open-minded man with amazing credentials and a true giant, no pun intended, in the field of Sasquatch research. I know that you have a healthy skepticism when it comes to Sasquatch. However, I know that you're also not a closed-minded individual and you value honest, real facts, data, and real science, and that's why this man's passing deserves a mention and some airtime on your show, I believe. Perhaps you could take a moment just to have a brief segment with some sound bites and talk about how his work really is the type of research needed to uncover this mystery. With so many nut jobs out there hoaxing and the laughable TV programs on today that are trying to quote-unquote find or kill Bigfoot, his work, passion, and voice is one for anyone with a real and honest interest into this enigma and should be honored and remembered. Regards, Dave from Washington, a very squatchy part of the world. Dave, thank you so much. Thanks to all you guys who wrote in this week and shared your ideas, your views, your perspectives, and stories with us. And when we come back, I'm going to take Dave's advice and do exactly what he suggested in his email. I want to feature a segment on this program about the life and work of John Bindernagel, probably one of the more underrated voices in cryptozoology, and also, in my opinion, one of the more eloquent and thoughtful, who tried to bring science and also philosophy of science into the equation when it comes to discussing this creature. We've got a lot to get into on the other side of this break. It is the Gray Alien Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and we'll be right back. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Gray Alien Report, keeping you company as always on Monday night, 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time. We're via KGRARadio.com. And remembering tonight, the late John Bindernagel. Of course, he was a renowned Sasquatch researcher who passed away recently from cancer. And I think we'll start right there with the Vancouver Island News reporting on his work. Of course, known around the world for his work in the field of Sasquatch research, he has died according to his family. Dr. John Bindernagel, a wildlife biologist, passed away Wednesday night after losing his battle with cancer. His son says Bindernagel never wavered in his desire to one day help solve the long-standing mystery of Sasquatch. Obviously, he was very passionate about what he was doing, and he had a good way of connecting with people, his son said. He wanted to somehow be able to give it some credibility. Now, Chris said that he and his family are still recovering from his father's death and are remembering the unique experiences that they shared. A lot of my fondest memories of my dad are from our time in East Africa. He was doing really interesting work there with National Park Management. We would go out to the generator every night and fire up the generator station to keep the place operating in the evening. In addition to East Africa, Bindernagel worked in the Caribbean and the Middle East and was also, or rather it was his from his Comox Valley home there in Vancouver that he lived out his true passion, talking with people about their Bigfoot encounters. He had that role where he felt like he could give it credibility because he had a background in traditional science, whereas some other people who were interested in Sasquatch don't have that kind of background to be able to make it legitimate. Members of the research community have been passing along their condolences and their admiration of the man who they say was a lead researcher and author. According to Bindernagel's family, the hunt for Sasquatch was a commitment he had had even through his dying days. Even last week, he was still thinking on these things, they said. He was still jotting down ideas and was able to take time to kind of be beside him, his son Chris said, I was able to take time to be beside him as a scribe, which was nice to get those things down. He said he will now endeavor to make more of his father's research available online so that others interested in learning about the fabled creature can access that. And they note it as a final point in the article that British Columbia has the highest number of Sasquatch sightings out of any province by far, with 130 recorded sightings between 1924 and 2013. And that according to the organization known as the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization, or sometimes as they're known, BFRO. Now, Bindernagel is interesting to me, and I'll tell you, I've edited down a couple of audio sound bites of lectures that he would put online where he illustrated some very unique points about the creature. And one that you're about to hear here, I mean, he had me from the word philosophy of science, because Bindernagel, rather than just trying to say, well, you know, let's look at the flesh and blood aspect of this creature, he was kind of looking at the philosophy, the social movements within the scientific establishment, and the kinds of movements. This, again, keep in mind, those listening, if you're not necessarily interested in cryptozoology, let alone a serious biological study about it, from the perspective of a credentialed biologist, remember what he's saying here could be applied to any unknown. We could apply exactly what you're about to hear Bindernagel talking about to UFOs. You could apply this to the study of apparitions like what we discussed last week with Danny Robbins. You could apply this to the unknown quantities of the physical universe, which astrophysicists, which chemists, you know, which physicists, which any number of people in different scientific disciplines might study. You could apply this same line of logic, because what it really involves are the attitudes and the discoveries and the interrelationship between the two leading up to acceptance of a new idea through science. And so without further ado, we remember John Bindernagel and his discussion of the philosophy of science as it relates to Sasquatch.
My name is John Bindernagel, a professional wildlife biologist who's been studying the Sasquatch as an unfolding discovery over many years. And I would like to consider the Sasquatch in terms of philosophy of science. Now, I know that sounds pretty dry, perhaps pretty boring to many people, but philosophy of science, as I've come to understand it, can be quite exciting because it does address unfolding discoveries, discoveries in general, and especially when some discoveries are not unfolding maybe as quickly as we might anticipate they would. And of course, the discovery of the Sasquatch is indeed such a discovery. Perhaps I can explain it through the work of philosopher of science Thomas Kuhn, who basically outlined how he perceived a discovery to unfold. He begins in the quote, which I used in the epigraph of my second book, because it was such a nice encapsulation of the discovery process. He writes, "If a paradigm is ever to triumph, it must gain some first supporters. Men and women who will develop it to the point where hard-headed arguments can be produced and multiplied." Well, let's start with the term paradigm, because what we are proposing here is a new paradigm for the Sasquatch, and that is that the Sasquatch is an existing North American mammal. The new paradigm must replace the old paradigm. And even those arguments, when they come, are not initially decisive. One may have been so convinced by the evidence supporting the new paradigm that they would be accepted almost initially, that would be unrealistic. However, Kuhn writes, because scientists are reasonable men and women, one or another argument will ultimately persuade many of them. So he makes a good point. But there is no single argument that can or should persuade them all. Now, fortunately or unfortunately, a single argument keeps being raised as an attempt to persuade them all. And that, of course, is the Patterson-Gimlin film, a great piece of visual evidence that is very convincing to many people. The problem with that piece of evidence is that it has been treated as the centerpiece of evidence. And the problem with that is that if that centerpiece of evidence supporting the new paradigm can be debunked, dismissed, shown to be a hoax, then by implication, the existence of the Sasquatch as an existing mammal has been debunked or dismissed. So, with due respect to my colleague and collaborator Bob Gimlin and Roger Patterson and those who support it, I suggest that that piece of evidence maybe be held aside a little more than it has been, and that we look at other forms of evidence, such as track evidence, eyewitness drawings, published historical accounts, vocalizations. There is, in fact, a great deal of other evidence. Okay, Kuhn goes on. Rather than a single group conversion, what occurs is an increasing shift in the distribution of professional allegiances. I think he's telling us here that rather than expecting a whole scientific discipline, such as my colleagues in wildlife biology, or such as mammalogists or physical anthropologists, to suddenly say, oh, gee, we accept the existence of this upright, hair-covered, great ape or human, whatever it is, there may be an increasing shift. Nevertheless, if they are competent, they being, I think, we proponents of the new paradigm, they will improve it. You know, even before we had that film, we had track evidence. We continue with examination of vocalizations, which cannot be attributed to cataloged, recognized North American mammals and birds, dismissing wolves, coyotes, owls, loons, and even humans, and bringing in other evidence, especially trace evidence, the twisting of branches and saplings, this physical evidence of a mammal either acting out an element of intimidation behavior or marking territory, again, something which we cannot yet attribute to another mammal, but which has been attributed, correctly or incorrectly, to the Sasquatch, and that warrants investigation. Explore its possibilities. Now, exploring its possibility is what gets us into trouble, because exploring the possibility that the Sasquatch is not merely a cultural phenomenon, not just a misidentified bear, not a hallucination, not a myth. In that narrow sense, we are saying, gee, there is this actual mammal out there leaving tracks, being observed, being filmed. The very distinct possibility is that existing prevailing knowledge will be to some extent overturned, possibly to quite a large extent. Unfortunately, people like me are not a good example of what it's like to be guided by this new paradigm because of the way I have been ignored by my scientific colleagues, by my sense of failure to attract my scientific colleagues to examples of evidence supporting the new paradigm. On the plus side, there's this very large, very supportive amateur investigating community who very much appreciates the participation of a scientist, you know, at the PhD level. And sadly, there currently, to my knowledge, is only the two of us, Professor Jeff Meldrum at Idaho State University and myself. But they do say things like, thank you for what you're doing, and thank you for coming to this Bigfoot conference and telling us about your interpretations and your own research. It's good and bad belonging to that community. And maybe that's the way it always is.
I do want to come to another soundbite here in a moment, but when you watch him online, if you look up videos of Dr. Bendernagle, the first thing you may notice is that he's a bit like the absent-minded professor. He has some funny little mannerisms and things about him, and he'll have to stop. He'll even get really carried away at some points, and they go, I'm sorry, excuse me, I need to calm down and speak more eloquently and professionally. What I love about him is he is a person who is constantly at odds with himself to try and contain his excitement about the subject that he's addressing, and to do so nonetheless in a way which he can communicate credibly to people who he would be or who might be perceived as his peers in the scientific community. He notes right there at the end of that soundbite his own personal failures in terms of being able to get scientists like him involved in or interested in this subject. I know that there are plenty of people who consider themselves critics of fringe ideas, who run what are a tantamount to hate blogs out there, who would sit there and they wouldn't hear the merit of the philosophical scientific discussion that Bendernagle is trying to offer. They would simply make fun of his mannerisms. They would call him a kooky old guy. They would laugh to kingdom come about the fact that he dare addresses something like Bigfoot. But the truth is, grow up, be mature enough to look at a person and hear their ideas and recognize a trained, qualified scientist with legitimate credentials and who is brave enough to put his reputation and, frankly, his income probably and other things on the line. He was brave enough to put his life into the study of something that he believed in and he thought that science could be applied to. There are very few people who have the cojones to do what Bendernagle did. Very few people who would put their credibility, their reputations at stake. Very few people who would engage a community that is willing to spit on them and throw stones because he's so crazy as to presume that there may be a life form out there that could exist based on cultural remembrances, mythology, folklore, modern accounts, and alleged encounters that people continue to say that they've had. However scant that evidence, he was willing to look at it like a good scientist should. And of course you can make an argument against somebody whether or not they are making a good scientific point or whether you like the way that they interpret the data, but you cannot fault a man who has gone through the rigors of studying scientifically, obtaining an education, traveling the world, and then he chooses with his time to apply his thought, effort, and energy towards something that he believes can move our knowledge forward. That's what any good scientist would, can, and should be doing. And unfortunately, I find that many people who are putting their reputations at stake by engaging subjects that may seem a little weird, they end up being fodder for skeptics, fodder for people who will not apply thought, intelligence, and energy, let alone a shred of open-mindedness, to a subject like Sasquatch. Yeah, it seems crazy for people who've never read any literature, who've never studied any books. And I, again, like Dave, who wrote the email, pointed out, I do walk a line of skepticism on Sasquatch myself, as I think any good scientist should, and Bendernagle did a good bit of that himself. But the point is, before you commit yourself to it couldn't be, and let's just ridicule people, because, you know, ridiculing people really gets the point across so well. This guy has been criticized. He was criticized up until the time he died, and yet on his deathbed was still scribbling notes about his passion, hoping that his contributions would help move science forward. The man was far more qualified than probably any of his critics.
Well, and I tell you, you put the link to his website here in the show notes page, and I've been going over it for the past few minutes as we were listening to that, and the website's put together beautifully. I don't think anybody on either side of the fence, whether you believe or disbelieve, would be opposed to this website. He has sections titled Evidence Under Evidence. It even has a section, a subheading of hoaxes. Let's discuss hoaxes for a moment. Let's discuss scientific responses to everything. This is obviously a man who's taking himself seriously as not just one of these weekend warrior researchers and should be seen as such by the greater community.
His book, by the way, that's available at the website Matt was talking about, and that website is sasquatchbiologist.org. The book is called The Discovery of the Sasquatch, Reconciling Culture, History, and Science in the Discovery Process. So again, somebody who's put a lot of thought, effort, energy, and who I think has applied scientific knowledge, both from a biological perspective, but also the philosophy of science to the question of Sasquatch. That is what a scientist should do, no matter how fringe the idea. Now, granted, if it's an idea that we can demonstrably prove as not being authentic, i.e. flat Earth, that's why we rail against flat Earth theories on this program, because those are no longer theories. There's good science that shows that that is not even a theory. And I know that some skeptics have said, and this is you know, something that has to be asked. If a skeptic says, well, what point can we say that with so little evidence of Bigfoot, we can close the book on that and stop studying? Fair question. I am skeptical. I am comfortable at times calling myself a skeptic, although, again, the attitudes of some skeptics gets under my skin enough that I really think that they do little to help move science forward. All they're doing is just gratifying their own egos and complaining and attacking people like Bendernagel. Not that anybody specifically comes to mind that has attacked him, but I'm sure that there are people like that, because if you watch him on YouTube, you'll see what I'm talking about. He was a bit, you know, I mean, I would say enjoyably bumbling there in his final years. There was a cute aspect about him that was almost the archetypal mad scientist. But stop, relate, listen, take in what he was saying, hear what the man had to say. I'm sorry, Matt, go ahead, and then we got one more soundbite I want to fit in of him elaborating further on his ideas.
Well, I just wanted to interject there. You had brought up, is there a point, you know, if we're being good skeptics, is there a point in which we stop looking? I think that is independent of the work like people like him do. That would be a philosophical discussion, not relevant to the research aspect of something. You know, I think there, as you and I have had the discussion 1,000 times over, there are many fingers to the same hand. So philosophy and research can be two separate fingers, and one can, you know, dictate or sway the other, but they need to remain separate. And I think we try and kind of use cumulative knowledge to conquer a topic all at once, instead of trying to, you know, isolate those fingers and conquer them one by one.
And I think that Bendernagel, in a way, is trying to orchestrate that, again, referencing Thomas Kuhn, that, and he actually refers to the prematurity of the discovery of Sasquatch, in the sense that reports that we have today do not jive with enough evidence that allows science to reconcile with the subject, but rather than listening to the reports and anecdotal that they are, saying, well, maybe there's something to see here. The way that he phrases the question, or rather the way he explains it, science looks at it and says, this is impossible, it couldn't exist. But it very well may be that at some point, either existing evidence will be viewed differently, or new evidence will come to light that will change perspectives of science, and then this existing body of data, which Bendernagel believed already constitutes the existence of said creature, it will be seen in a different light. We've got more audio sound bites here.
It appears, in the case of the discovery of the Sasquatch, that we have made this leap suddenly from nothing resembling the Sasquatch in North America to suddenly, maybe in 1967, it being filmed full-blown in Northern California, or suddenly, even just in 1958, its tracks appearing in Northern California. And that's something called prematurity in scientific discovery. And prematurity is when a discovery claim is premature because there aren't all these links and steps leading up to it in canonical or generally available knowledge. Well, as I took some pains to to document, these steps, in fact, were in place. We just failed to recognize them. Without going all the way back into Aboriginal mythology, which is very, very helpful, very fruitful, there are the historical accounts, published historical accounts of settlers and pioneers who described Sasquatches, certainly in the mid-1800s, into the late 1800s, and then, of course, increasing not just pioneers and settlers, but recreationists, prospectors, outdoors people in general, trappers, observing Sasquatches in the early 1900s. Some of these accounts being published, but no one quite understanding these reports. We didn't yet have the idea of an upright primate other than a human here in North America. So there were problems. Anyway, I think the discovery of the Sasquatch will eventually be seen to fit normal science. until at last a few elderly holdouts remain. Well, sort of, I wish. I mean, I do encounter people my age, and I'm very sympathetic. Yeah, I know it seems really bizarre, but what concerns me more is young scientists or young students in science who have, I guess the word would be, bought into prevailing knowledge of the Sasquatch as a hoax, a joke, and increasingly as a subject of entertainment. I won't get going on the Sasquatch or Bigfoot as a subject of entertainment at this point, but that's what has happened. And, you know, in being a subject of entertainment, some people have played rather fast and loose with accuracy in depictions and representations of the evidence available. And I hate to say trivialized Sasquatch research, but it certainly appears to be that way. And, you know, reality TV shows having become kind of the face of Sasquatch research to many North Americans. Some of us feel we may have been misrepresented. So it's not just elderly holdouts. But I'm going to stop there for now. Thank you very much.
And that's the late Dr. John Bendernagel. Again, note that he points out young people who in their education systems have been taught what to think, not how to think, and therefore they take for granted that there's nothing to see here, move along, nothing of substance to Sasquatch. You are to ridicule that idea because it is an idea that is only worthy of ridicule. On the other side of things, why is that perception existent today? Why may had it, could it have been different in earlier times? What has changed? Well, again, where do we hear about Bigfoot these days? Not in universities, not in books written by biologists and qualified individuals. It's on TV shows that are either trying to find something that they've never found or that they're trying to kill something they don't know whether it exists or not. And Bendernagel took issue with all those things, rightly so. He was a gentleman, a scholar, a thinker, and a passionate scientist who put his life and his work into this subject, and we commend him tonight on the Graylian Report for doing so.
And if you don't already love him, you have to love the fact that you can find him quoting The Demon Haunted World by Carl Sagan all over his website, which is just beautiful.
He looked up to Carl Sagan. I'm sure that, like many, he probably had certain intellectual differences with Carl Sagan. I do too. I have a lot of intellectual differences with people who I respect and scientists I look up to, but I also think that there is a case to be made for open-mindedness. Bendernagel was a shining light in a black sea of infinity, to quote Lovecraft, on the subject of the weirdness of our universe. And I think that from time to time, opening your eyes and looking at the weirdness rather than turning a blind eye to it at all times is indeed a better way to eliminate the problems. That will be the final word for this week's edition of the Graylian Report. Proud to be your host as always. And on behalf of all of us here at Graylian International Studios, including Chris Hayes, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, Rayson Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Jason Pintrail, Tiffany Mack, and the lovely assistant Lauren, Matthew and I bid you adieu, and until next time, stay strange out there.
Listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website GraylianReport.com.